Well, tonight, Genesis chapter 38, between the story of Joseph, we introduced Joseph last week, and he's been sold into slavery. But before we follow Joseph down, we're going to tell the story of Judah. Now, Judah's very important in the history of the Bible, the person, the lineage, because it's going to lead to the Messiah. Judah is going to lead to the Messiah, even Jacob's prophecy on his deathbed, and we've looked ahead and looked at that. It's going to be the scepter will not depart from Judah until it comes to the one to whom it belongs. So the kingship is going to come from Judah. Now, last thing we saw as far as Judah individually was last week in chapter 37 when the brothers wanted to kill Joseph and throw him in the pit. Reuben convinced them to just throw him in there alive and let him suffer, and then he was going to come back and release him. But when he came back, he found that Judah had suggested that they sell him to the caravan going past Dothan. And so Judah was the one who suggested selling him. So in a sense, he saved his life, but at the same time, he's gone. Joseph is gone, and as far as the boys are concerned, they'll never see him again. Chapter 38, just a heads up, this is an what we'd say adults only chapter. There's a few things taking place in here that it's one of the things that as a kid, as you know, I'm growing up, I remember getting up in the mornings and going downstairs when I was out on the farm at my grandpa's house, Grandpa Weimer's, and he'd always be sitting in his chair that he'd probably sat in since 1935 when they moved into the farm place, and he'd have his coffee and he'd be reading his Bible. That's just what he did. He read his Bible in the morning. And as a kid, I also remember seeing my dad getting to bed, and my dad, before he'd go to sleep, he'd have a Bible and he'd read a chapter out of his Bible. Neither one of them really, read me Bible stories. I saw them go to church, but there's not like, let me sit down and tell you the story. But I saw them both reading the Bible. So I don't know how old I was. I maybe was a freshman in high school, 15, 16, I don't know how old I was. But I started reading my Bible. And of course, you go to Sunday school, you hear your Sunday school stories, and you hear your Christian character, and you know a little bit about Jesus. Just because I went to church every Sunday, went to Sunday school, went to vacation Bible school. But then you start reading the Bible. And, as a kid, I said, I'm going to start reading my Bible. I'm going to get a Bible. I always had a Bible in my room and never read it. But about 14, 15, 16, somewhere along there, probably a freshman in high school, I said, it's time for me to read my Bible. So I lay down in bed one night and opened it up to Genesis chapter 1, and you've all tried this before, and started reading. Oh, I recognize this. This is not going to be too hard. Chapter 2, chapter 3, and then you get some interesting stories. And then you get to a chapter like this, like in my second month of reading a chapter. I'd read an Old Testament chapter, I'd read a New Testament chapter. About my second month, I don't remember hitting this chapter, but when I remember hitting chapters like this or reading stuff like this, like, whoa. This is in the Bible? It's like, does my mom and dad know I'm reading this stuff? It's like, my gosh. It's like, and you'd be like, it's just like an eye-opening. It's like, my gosh, what kind of book is this? And that's, we're going to run into some of that kind of stuff like this. And I'm reading from the English Standard Version. So here we go. It says, after chapter 37, Joseph's been sold. Before we continue that story, it happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Now, at that time, that would mean after they brought the cloak back, the coat of many colors to Jacob, and Jacob has gone into mourning. His gray head is going to go down to Sheol, in mourning. And the brothers all kind of know what took place. It says, at that time, Judah separated. Now, you've seen them together, and they're not like little kids. They're not like teenagers or in their 20s. These guys have got wives. They've got families of their own. But at this time, Judah decides it's time to branch off. Maybe he's going to go start his own family. He's going to get his own, herds. But he goes up, and now he's going to be living with Canaanites. Remember, the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is now the 12 sons and their wives and the children they're producing. Judah goes away from the family of Abraham. He doesn't go back up and get, you know, Rebecca and Rachel's, you know, daughter or granddaughter or nephew or niece from Abraham's family. He goes over to, and I've got a map there for you that's going to be useful, because just kind of, it all kind of takes place the same place. There's the Dead Sea, the Galilee. Here's Jerusalem. That is not part of our story. Here's Hebron, kind of where the people, you know, of Abraham, you know, that's where Jacob's been living, in Hebron. It's too low on there. We're going to put Hebron right about here. It's in the middle of the Dead Sea. Here's the coast. Now, remember, this is the coastal plain. This is the flat land. The caravans travel here. But as these hills roll, that's called the Shephelah, or it's the hill country. It's the roll, just climbing hill country until it gets into a mountainous region right here. And we talk about mountainous regions. We're not talking about snow-capped mountains. It just gets higher. So this is the hill country called the Shephelah. And there's Hebron. There's a place called Adullam. David will eventually hide in the cave of Adullam when the story comes around. When he's running from Saul, he'll hide in a cave of Adullam. And then north of that would be Timnah. And we know Timnah from the stories of Samson. Samson runs this territory right in here. So Judah is going to go away from his brothers up to Adullam, and this is Canaanite territory. It doesn't, this chapter, it's not offended by the Canaanites. There's just the people living in the land, and this is the story of Judah. So he goes away from his brothers, and he goes up to Adullam, and then he meets an Adullamite there named Hira. And so this is one of his friends. This guy's going to be with Judah. Make sure I spell it right. H-I-R, it's simple. H-I-R-A-H. That's a Canaanite friend of Judah that's going to be throughout this story. There, Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite. Now, there's no doubt it describes him, whose name was Shua. Now, here's another guy. We'll just put his name here too, Shua. And this guy's going to have a daughter. We do not know the daughter's name. It's the daughter of Shua. There Judah saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. That's the man. He took her and went into her. So he's going to take her. They get married. Now, that would indicate that Judah, during this whole time, has not been married yet. Some of the boys are married, we are going to assume. Judah is not, but he is married to now the daughter of Shua, and he's living near Adullam with, he's got pasture. He's pasturing sheep. And Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er, E-R. There's going to be three sons. This is Er, E-R. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. O-N-A-N. So now he's got two sons. Judah's doing real good. I mean, remember, this is Judah, and I may end up saying it wrong. Not Jacob, because we talk about, I may say Jacob, and I'm really talking about Judah, so keep listening. So we're into Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now Judah. Yet again, she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Now notice, Shua's daughter, Judah's wife, is naming the children. And that's Shelah. S-H-E-L-A-H. So these are... They're the children of a Canaanite woman. So right now, Judah, who's a descendant of Abraham, is married a Canaanite. Now, these are half Abrahamic, or half Israel, half Canaanite. After Shelah was born, Judah was in Chezbib when she bore him. Now, we don't know where Chezbib is, but it's probably in the Shephelah, the low hill country here. You know, this is where he's at. He's probably in this area. That there's no reason he's moved northwest of Hebron. This is where his fields are. And throughout the story, Hira is going to be his friend, and Hira is from Adullam. So Judah has probably moved, you know, further, closer to the coast, maybe closer to the trade routes or something. But he's in that area. That's what we know, Chezba. And Judah took a wife. Now, again, now we're going to go, Ir is going to be, we're going to go through like 18 years. Right, all of a sudden, he was in Chezbib when Shelah was born. So Ir and Onan are, you know, 5-10 years old. And now he's gone up here to Chezra. And now Ir is going to get married. So now Ir is 18 or 20 years old. So this whole, so far we've covered 20 years. Meanwhile, Joseph has been in Egypt for 20 years. And while Joseph's been in Egypt for 20 years, we got to go back and catch all of that up. He's going to be in Potiphar's house. He's going to be in prison. He's going to talk to the cupbearer. He's going to talk to the baker. He's going to predict the 7 years of famine. He's going to predict the 7 years of plenty. 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. And all that's taking place down here during this 20 years. So there's some time taking place that just we just rush by it. Okay. And Judah took a wife for Ira, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. Okay, we got a name of a girl. We got Tamar. Tamar herself is a Canaanite. She's from this area. And she is going to be married to Ira. Ira and Tamar. Notice, Judah chooses his wife, but Judah also chooses Tamar to be Ira's wife. And this is, he's building his family. He's building his flocks. But Ir, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. That's all we know. I mean, you can speculate, but there's a lot of wickedness. It could be sexual immorality. It could be financial immorality. He could be, you know, killing people, slaughtering a city. I mean, you can't think of anything more worse than slaughtering Sechem. So you don't know what that is. You don't know what kind of wickedness. Maybe he started a satanic cult. Maybe he's visiting the Canaanite Baal temples or something. We don't know. It doesn't say. And the interesting thing is, the Lord put him to death. It's not like, finally we've got Ira. Finally, we've got an evil person on the earth, and God is going to select him and put him to death, as if there's never been an evil person before. Well, there has been, but what has not taken place in the text of Scripture before is God selecting an individual to be put to death. Now, he's intervened in people's lives. He's wiped out the earth with the flood. He's caused different things to take place, but he just selects this individual and says, you are wicked, you cannot live any longer. And he takes him out of the existence. So that's all we know. Judah's firstborn son, Ir, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan. Now, we have, if you look over in the notes, the one that's got two pages of notes on it, chapter 38, verse 8, what is known as the Levirate marriage. I'm not sure how to say it, Levirate marriage. And don't be confused, it's got nothing to do with Levi, okay? It looks like, right, well, you want to go Levi, the tribe of Levi. The Hebrew word is Yibum, Y-I-B-B-U-M, transliterated. But Levir is the Latin word for brother-in-law. So Levirate marriage is Latin and English mixed together to capture the Hebrew word Yibum. And Levir means brother-in-law, so Levirate marriage means brother-in-law marriage. It was a custom of this time period in the Middle East. It's in the Near East, ancient Near East. It's in the law of Moses, an effect to it. But it was practiced because if a woman loses her husband, she's got her sons. And so her sons can provide for her in her old age, you know, throughout her life and in her old age, she's got a family. And a family was important. That was the the security, the social security. That was the way the system was set up. But if a woman loses her husband before she has any children, now who's going to take care of her? Well, you know, the Democratic Party's got a plan to give everyone, you know, everybody else's money or something like this. So though they don't, there's no social security, there's no plan. And so the plan would be the brother-in-law or the brother of the deceased brother would then marry her. And that would be called a brother-in-law marriage. And the reason for that would be that she can have children. Now, it's possible that the brother-in-law or the brother-in-law is already married, in which case she would go to him and she would just conceive and begin to build a family. It'd be his responsibility to basically impregnate her so she could have a family. Now, that's what happens right here. So, then Judah, after his oldest son has died, and he's got Tamar, this woman that he selected for his son, then Judah said to Onan, his second son, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. Now, he doesn't say anything about marriage. You could say it would be a marriage. Judah, again, we don't have the law of Moses. The law of Moses is not in effect. Many cultural things are going to appear in the law of Moses, be refined in the law of Moses by God, and then continue. God's not going to just create an entire new culture. They're going to have the same price as the slaves in the culture, be the same price as a slave in the law of Moses. It's going to be just the culture and their practices. You know, he's not going to give them cell phones, and no one else has a cell phone. He's going to give them ram's horns, and they're going to communicate with, you know, shofars or ram's horns. It's going to be the culture just brought into God's perspective. So there will be brother-in-law marriages in the law of Moses, and it will be refined. So this is the foundation of the law of Moses or a culture, but we can't read ahead and say they're doing this because it's going to be in the Mosaic law. Now, if you are a liberal scholar, you would say, oh, they're writing this after the law of Moses. They're writing this back after they've already gone forward in history. But because of the way these things are written, there's certain things even in this chapter that indicate that's not the way they do it in the law of Moses. That's not the way they did it. There's only time that we find these things happening is when it took place, you know, 1900, 1800 B.C., go into your brother and perform your duty of a brother-in-law. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. Well, why would he care? It's like, here's a son for Tamar, or child for Tamar, for her to have a child and raise a child. Well, it could, one, affect his inheritance from Judah, who's busy building his own estate. And so if Er has no children, well, all of a sudden, instead of dividing Judah's estate in thirds, Judah's estate is going to be divided in half, Onan's and Shelah's. So that's one reason. It may be he doesn't want anything to do with this connection. He wants his own. But for some reason, now again, this is not an option. This is the cultural practice. You need to perform your duty and produce children for Er. And so Er can have, you know, a family line coming from Er, and they'd be using Onan's seed to produce a line for Er. Nonetheless, it is the correct thing to do, legal thing to do, the moral thing to do is go to Tamar and produce a child. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so whenever he went to his brother's wife, now he didn't just do it once, he went often to his brother's wife. So whenever he went to his brother's wife, good, you're doing your brother-in-law duty. You're going to your brother's wife. Thank you for participating in this family activity. So he's doing his legal duty, his family duty, his moral duty, going to Tamar. Thank you. Judah is appreciating. The families of Tamar's father is appreciating. Thank you for your service, Onan. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would, here it is, waste the semen on the ground. Now, again, we're all adults here. We're not going to go into detail or have any kind of explanation. But he would be performing his duty with Tamar and then spill his seed on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. He looked like he was moral. He looked like he was a team player, but he was being selfish and nothing was happening. But I'll be back next week to do my job again until you conceive. Well, at this rate, she's going to be being visited by Onan for the next 20 years and never get pregnant. And no one knows. There's no one there observing the event. No one knows but Onan himself. It's like, well, and you do the conversation. Why is she not getting pregnant? Maybe she can't conceive. Maybe God is judging her. Onan knows. Well, no, I know why she's not getting pregnant. So he's being immoral. He's being selfish. And what he did was, a lot of times we read these stories, like we read that story about Joseph and telling his dreams, and it's like, was he being arrogant? Was he being ignorant? What's going on there? The narrator never tells you. It's just, that's what he did, and here's what happened. Well, who was right and who was wrong? Well, right here, we get a decision and concerning this event, and what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord. And there again, the word Lord is Yahweh, in the sight of Yahweh, and he put him to death also. So Onan, you didn't do your job. Now Onan's dead. Now this is not looking good for Tamar, because no one knows what was going on here. The writer of the book does. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up. See, Shelah's now 12 years old, I don't know, or 9 years old, or 14 years old, but he's not 18 or 16 or whatever the age for marrying. Shelah's still growing up. You go back to your father's house and live in his house, and I'll come get you, or I'll send Shelah to you so he can do the brother-in-law duty. Now, as the story's going to go, Judah's got no intention of sending Shelah because he's already lost son number one. He's down to the position where he may be in the same spot Tamar's at with no children if he sends Shelah to Tamar. So it says, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brother. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house, and there's no connection, there's no communication. Now, going on with the story, life goes on. We've got sheep, we've got herds, we've got harvest season, you've got to take the grain up on the threshing floor, you've got to come out, you've got to shear the sheep, you've got harvest, you've got planting season, harvest season, you've got the time the lambs are born, then you've got the shearing season. Well, in the course of time, the wife of Judah, now, we don't know her name. Shua's daughter died. So now, Shua's daughter, she's dead, which makes Judah himself a widower. So you've got a widow, Tamar. You've got Judah, a widower. And you've got Shelah, this kid that's growing up. He's still in high school. And now, Shua's daughter has died. We don't know anything about that. When Judah was comforted, meaning he mourned, maybe probably not as serious mourning as Jacob did when he lost Joseph, but he probably went through his 30 days of mourning. All we know about Shua's daughter, we don't know her name, and Judah is that they produced 3 children. That's all we know of their relationship. So this mourning, it could have been intense. It doesn't seem like it would have been, but nonetheless, he did go through the rituals of mourning or being comforted. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah, and now you can see Timnah. He goes up to Timnah. Now, this is his friend. He's in this area somewhere, but now he goes up to Timnah in this area for the event. Timnah, to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. So they've got their herd somewhere between Adullam and Timnah, apparently. And their sheep shears is up here, so they're going to drive their herds, their flocks up here. And this is harvest season, which means It's a festive time. It's the sheep shearing season. It would involve a bunch of men bringing all their flocks up to the sheep shears, and they're collecting the wool. It's a great windfall of money. It's in wool, but it's going to be sold. So this is the harvest time. This is a big deal. Celebration, windfall. Everybody's got money. And so he goes up with his friend Hira, the Canaanite, up to the sheep shears up here at Timnah. And when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So we don't know who told Tamar, but Tamar apparently is living at Timnah, where, you know, that'd be fine. But she somehow knows that she's waiting for this Shelah. She knows that, hey, you'll be interested. Your father-in-law, that you can't get, he won't pick up the phone. His sheep are coming up here next week for the sheep shears. Okay. So when Judah was comforted, okay, and when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's garments. So she's been wearing widow's garments all this time, and covered herself with a veil. Now that veil could be a full head covering. It could be just the eyes. The important thing is that her eyes are covered. That's definitely in the language. Veil, wrapping herself up and set at the entrance to Aniam, which is on the road to Timnah. So there's another city right here, Enaim, and it's on the way to Timnah. So as he's going from Adullam through the city here up through Enam, she's sitting right there on the road with her eyes covered. And apparently this is the symbol for a prostitute. Now, we do have some conversation about prostitutes, but also cultish prostitutes. Both terms are used here. Some commentators say there was no cultish prostitution going on here. That means you would, to worship your God, you'd go to a prostitute and worship your God through sexual practices. But there definitely were prostitutes for just sexual practices. When you get to the book of Hosea, I've got it referenced here somewhere on the notes. It's clearly during threshing season, the cult prostitutes would come out, and there'd even be on the cult, the threshing floor, sexual practices with cult prostitutes, which, you're, again, it's got to do with worshiping the fertility gods, you know, Baal, Asherah. That's all taking place in northern Israel in the book of Hosea, and we can make a connection. Other commentators say, or historians say, there was no cultish practice going on like that at this time. There definitely is going to be, but nonetheless, she's not a cult prostitute, but she's dressing up as a prostitute, and it says right here. Now remember, Judah doesn't have a wife, so he's not committing adultery. I'm not justifying it, but there's a list of things that goes through here. If Judah is wrong, Judah's going to be wrong in this chapter. Judah is wrong, but he's wrong for not giving Shelah to Tamar. Now again, we can go through and make a list of moral things and say he shouldn't be visiting a prostitute. But he's not committing adultery. But that's really not the focus of it. You can make that the focus of this chapter. The focus of this chapter, he's not helping take care of Tamar. She's destitute because he won't give her Shelah or give her his last son. Okay. She took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up and set at the entrance of Aniam, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was growing up. He's in college already, or he's already got his own business. He's a man, and she had not been given to him in marriage. The time has come. So it's been 4, 5, 6 years at least. And I haven't got any notification from the courts, from the lawyers, from Judah, from anybody saying, okay, it's time to start your family. So I'm destitute. And she's been destitute now for possibly a decade. She's got no children. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute. So she's sitting there on the side with her eyes covered, which would indicate, as we read this, that that was a sign. You can say, well, that's not the way it is today, or that is the way it is today. That's the way he saw her, sitting on the side of the road with her eyes covered. maybe her head covered. And he goes, ah, there's a prostitute. For she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and says, come, let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So he wants to come into her, just like he told Onan to go into her and produce a family. Now Judah says, so it's the terminology for, you know, let's go to bed. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She says, now watch this, what will you give me that you may come into me? Now, I need some kind of assurance. I need some kind of security. He answered, I will send you a young goat. I will give you a young goat if I can spend some time with you from the flock. And she says, if you give me a pledge until you send it, okay, that sounds good. I'll send you a goat. I'm going to need your credit card numbers first. Or I'm going to need your driver's license. I need some kind of security so that I can make sure you send me the goat. Now, first of all, he doesn't know it's Tamar, but she knows it's Judah. I've been waiting for 5 to 10 years for Shelah, and he's never shown up. How do I know you're going to send me a young goat? I need some security. Now, he doesn't know he's dealing with her, but she knows she's dealing with him. So, he said, what pledge shall I give you? My passport, my credit card, my driver's license? She replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. She's asking for three things. She's asking for the signet, which would be a seal. Now, there are signet rings that are stones that are carved out, and they're in existence at this time, and you'd press them into, you'd flip the stone over with the image and press it into the clay or the document or seal it. But this most likely is a cylinder seal. How do you spell cylinder seal? You'd roll it out, and the cord could be some kind of a belt that distinguishes, it's got color, it's got identifications, to identify who he is. Or the cord could be like right here, like this. Am I going to get caught up in my microphone? So the cord could be a belt with some identification, or the cord could be the cord going through the seal. Now what I have here, and Steve's got one also, and I'll pass these around. If you take that paper that I gave you at the beginning, there's pictures on that. There's three seals. These are authentic. This one is from Mesopotamia. It's a limestone cylinder seal. I've got 200 to 1,000 BC. I need two. It's 2,000. So this is from the same time period, roughly. Something we don't know for sure, but this is a seal, and you can roll it out. I'll pass this over here. Here's this one. It looks like this. All right. Here is the other one there that's also from Mesopotamia. This is a steatite cylinder seal from also 2000, 1000 BC. And this, you can see, that you can look at the images. This one's got some pretty cool images as far as some figurative animals. And then from around 800 to 600 BC, I've got this Chalcedony stone cylinder seal. And look how small this one is. This is from probably 1,000 years after our story. And there's an image of what I rolled out right there. It's got a winged genie, a fish, a crescent, a star crescent, and then another winged genie there. And this is a little bit smaller. They'd wear them around their neck, and these are rolled. Now, Steve has one. And, Steve, I want you to show yours, please, and tell them what it is. Those are, you can compare them. Look at the pictures. You kind of see what they are. That first one that I gave you, the limestone, there's like a little antelope or some kind of a deer, and it's got two holes, kind of like an eye. Now, Steve's got one. Now, say that word for us. Who wants to say that word?
This one's Akkadian.
Okay, this is Akkadian. Okay.
Lapis.
Lapis. You want to say it?
Lazuli.
Okay. These are brilliant. They're like a blue. This is the color of the stone. These are and Steve's got a rolled out. He's actually got a rolled out. And there's, you see, Steve's got, there's a hole in that too, right? There's a hole. All of those cylinder seals would have a hole in them for a cord to be put in. 300 BC. 23, okay, so 2,300 BC. So that would be, that's in operation up here. See the ziggurat in Ur? This is this time period right here. See, there's a ceramic seal right here that I've got that is round from that time period. Here's a cuneiform. But nonetheless, this is what, besides, and there's one more thing, it's going to be his staff. So you can decide if the cord is a belt. Is it three items? One, two, three items are mentioned. If you go through here, you'll see that there's a theme of three throughout this chapter. The husband and wife, Judah and his wife, there's three verbs describing them. Judah has three children. Here's three things that are given. And I just because it, I like the way it goes, I think the cord and the seal go together as far as this. But nonetheless, this is what she has. And this, people would use this, this is like a driver's license, or this is like signing a check. This is your credit card. This is you signing a document. You'd roll your name or your image into an item. So she asks him for something, and he gives it to her. I mean, just think, would you, someone says, well, I'm going to, well, we do it all the time. We give people our, you know, credit cards or debit cards. I guess, you know, he's going to get it back. He's going to send a goat, and he'll get all these things back. He's not too worried about it. It doesn't vary. Again, it's a, my map's all messed up, but this is not a, it's not a large area. I mean, they're within miles of each other. Okay, let's read on. Verse 17, he answered, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge until you send it. And he said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet, that's your cylinder seal, your cord, possibly the cord that's wrapped around his neck, or it could be his belt of some sort, your staff that is in your hand. And that staff would, again, have some identification on it. It may be the family, indicates the headship of the family, like a scepter. Or it could just be a personalized, you know, he's got his name carved in the staff. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Now she gets pregnant. He doesn't know he's doing the brother-in-law right here. Then she arose and went away. And taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. She goes back to her normal life, but now she's conceived a child. Tamar wins. Again, what's interesting here is you've got, throughout this book of Genesis, you've got women stepping up. They're in their roles in society, but they can step out and create some activity. If it be Rachel, or if it be Rebecca, if it be Sarah, if it be Hagar. I mean, these women are not invisible. They've got a role in their, as God has created them, but these women are making history as they're going around. And Tamar right here, who's now the destitute widow with no family, well, I've solved my problem. What's your retirement plan? Well, I'm going to sleep with my father-in-law, conceive a child. All right. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to take back it in the, to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. So he sends from Adullam, he sends Hira with the young goat up here to Anim on the way to Timnah, and can't find where's she at. So he follows up. He wants his credit card back. He wants his passport. He wants his driver's license back. He wants his seal, his cylinder seal back. And he asks the men of that place, quote, now it's not prostitute. This is where it comes up. Where is the cult prostitute who was at Anim at the roadside? And so that would, if that's the right translation, prostitute, now it's cult prostitute, that would mean she may have been involved, or Judah thought she was involved with the cultic activities going on during the sheep shearing season. And they says, no cult prostitute has been here. So he returned to Judah and says, I have not found her. Also, the men of the place said, no cult prostitute has been there. They don't practice that. And Judah replied, let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. Now again, he doesn't say, I will be. He says, we. If I send you back up there and you're looking for it, it's like, we're both going to be made fun of or be mocked. And again, look at what he says. Let her keep the things as her own. It's your signature seal. It's your staff. Are these things just cheap? Or is he just, he just doesn't seem to care. So he doesn't care about these things. Just let it go. Otherwise, we'll embarrass ourselves. It's gonna go away. But he's going to also be just as calm as he is about this. He's going to be as rash here in just a few moments. And Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her. See, I did my part. I sent the young goat. You didn't find her. Case closed. What do I care?" Well, about 3 months later, Judah was told, now Tamar showing, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, who's living like a widow, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality." And Judah says, "Bring her out and let her be burned." Now, culturally, that is it's not a cultural practice. It's not like, well, yep, you see, in those days, they burned women when they got pregnant on an immoral. There's not an example of this. Even in the law of Moses, there's burning as punishment, but it is, you know, there's stoning, there's, decapitation, there's different things that can take place, but burning is way down the line. I mean, you've got to go way, and it's got to be like some kind of public demonstration. And he's gonna burn her. She's pregnant, we're going to burn her. Not to mention, well, what do you expect her to do? She's been hanging out for 10, 15 years waiting for Sheila. And you won't let her be married, so what's she going to do? And Judah says, "Bring her out and let her be burned." And as she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, "By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant." I can tell you who the immoral man was that impregnated me. Here's his seal. Here's his cord, and here's his staff. I mean, it's like, here's your signature, Judah. Did you sign this? Let me see. Oh, yes, you signed this package. And she says, "Please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff." Then Judah identified them and says, "Oh, she is more righteous than I, since I did not..." Now watch. "She is more righteous than I." Now, as the Christian, I'm not making fun of him. I'm not trying to be sexually, you know, insensitive or immoral. But right away, the Christian goes, "Ah, he shouldn't have been sleeping with a prostitute." Okay, that's another conversation. That's not the theme of this chapter. The theme of this chapter is he was not taking care of Tamar. He was not fulfilling his moral, righteous duty of providing for her and just let her go on her own. It says, "Then Judah identified them and said, 'She is more righteous than I.'" He doesn't say, "I should not have been sleeping with a prostitute. I'm so sorry." He says, "Since I did not give her to my son Sheila." What's he guilty of in his mind? What does he say? "She's more righteous than me. I should have gave her Sheila. That was my moral obligation." And he did not know her again. He did not sleep with her again, that she doesn't become his wife. Now again, remember, he didn't commit adultery because he has no wife. And again, we're not justifying his sexual behavior, because what is interesting is you turn the page or turn the chapter, Joseph now is all of a sudden morally superior because he avoids sexual sin and ends up in prison because of it. So there is that comparison coming. "When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out his hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, 'This one came out first.'" Now, it's important, as you know, who the firstborn is, because the firstborn has the greater inheritance. The firstborn becomes the leader. That's why Ishmael should have been the leader instead of Isaac. Or Esau should have been the leader instead of Jacob. But God chose the younger. Where here, the first one, he's got the string on his hand because he came out first. But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out first. And she says, "What a breach you have made for yourself about the firstborn boy." meaning, you know, you breached through, you broke out, you forced your way through. There's a baby blocking your way. They're already got their hand out of the womb, and this other baby pushes himself through. And the midwife says, "What a breach you have made." Therefore, his name was called Perez, P-E-R-E-Z, which has the idea of breaking out, forcing through. Afterward, his brother came out and the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. So you've got Judah's sons. So you've got Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, and Perez, and then his brother Zerah, and their mother is Tamar, the Canaanite. That's his, and that's the way the genealogy is going down. We've got this story, and that's one of the reasons why this story is here. And if you go to, well, just go to, the best place to go would be to Ruth. Go to the book of Ruth after Judges there. And, oh, there's so many things in Ruth that can correlate to this. You know the story of Ruth. She's a Moabite. And she had married in chapter 1, verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land of Israel. And a man of Bethlehem of Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He had his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. And the name of his wife was Naomi. Now you know that, Naomi. And then she's got two sons. The two sons go there. They marry Moabite women. But the sons die. The father dies. And now Naomi, the Jewish woman, the Israelite woman, is left with these two Moabite women, Ruth and what's the other one's name? Orpah are left. And then it comes time for Naomi to go back to Israel. And she says, "You guys stay here. We'll just forget anything. And you go find a nice Moabite man to get married. I'll go back and figure something out." Well, Naomi is childless and a husbandless. Her husband died, her two sons died. So she's coming back like a Tamar back in the land of Israel during the days of the judges. And Orpah, one of the Moabite girls, goes, "Okay, I'll go back to my family and I'll start over. I'll take care of myself." Ruth says, "I can't let you go by yourself. I have to go with you. You don't have any children. I don't have any children. I'm going to stick with you." So she goes, Ruth, the Moabite, goes back to Israel. Now, chapter 4, there's the account right here of what takes place here, and it will break down the story. It's the same or a similar thing. There's a piece of property that goes to along with the son that Ruth was married to, and a guy, there's a order of son-in-laws or men that could buy this property because it belongs to this line, the tribal line. And so the man comes up and says, "Okay, there's a whole story going on here." He says, "Yes." He says, "Okay, I'll go ahead and buy that land. I'll redeem that land from that individual, and that will become, I'll take care of that land." And then Boaz says, "Well, you know, you can, but if you do, you've got to marry the woman that comes with the land." It's like, "What? I didn't know there's a woman involved." Well, if in the law of Moses, and now the law of Moses by the book of Ruth, the law of Moses is in effect. In the law of Moses, rushing through this, is if a brother-in-law will not marry the wife, there is a public ceremony. And that's where she takes off the man's sandal, and he says, I don't want to marry. I don't want to jeopardize my estate, my family. No, I don't want anything to do with this." Now, in the law of Moses, you can back out. Like, Onan couldn't back out. He just got killed. You can back out, but she'll take your sandal, slap your face, and spit at you, or something to that effect. And what takes place right here is when the man finds out that Ruth comes with the property, He takes off his sandal publicly, and where is it at here? I'm looking in chapter 4, verse 10. Also, Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, that's Naomi's son, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off among the brothers from the gate of his native place, you witnesses they. Then all the people who are at the gate and the elders says, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who are coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built the house of Israel. May you act worthily, and goes talks about that. Go back to verse 5. Then Boaz said, the day you buy the field, he's talking now to the kinsman redeemer, from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Then the redeemer, kinsman redeemer, says, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption, you yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now, this was the custom in the former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. The one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting itself. So the woman doesn't take it off in this case, but the man takes off his own sandal. So whom the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. He drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the peoples, you are witness this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion, and I also get Ruth. And so that takes place. Now what's interesting is go to chapter 4, verse 8, and now it's going to tell you the lineage right here at the end of Ruth. And this is why chapter 38 is important, is right here in Ruth chapter 4, verse 18. Now these are the generations of Perez. Who's Perez? Perez is the firstborn of Judah and Tamar, the one that came out first after Zerah had the string tied. Ruth, the book of Ruth ends, these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Now we're up into the time of, we're going through the Egypt. Now we're up into the time of the wilderness and the spies. Nahshon fathered Salmon, and Salmon, he marries Rahab. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. So this Perez right here goes straight up to David. I'm going to read you one more thing. Go to Matthew. You'll see the same genealogy in Matthew. I want you to look at it, and then I'm going to show you one more thing. Matthew chapter 1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Abinadab, Abinadab the father of Nahshon, Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab. See? So there's Canaanites throughout here. And Boaz, the father of Obed, and by Ruth, the Moabite, and Obed, the father of Jesse. So Jesse is Canaanite, Moabite, I mean, all the way through. And I want to show you this on your notes, that's got two pages of notes at the very bottom of the page. Dennis Prager, a Jew, a great commentator, great intelligent academic, he writes this in his book on chapter 38, verse 29. This is Dennis Prager, a Jew. He's not a Christian. He says, according to the genealogy recorded in the fourth chapter of the book of Ruth, Perez later became the ancestor of David. Now, we just read that. And therefore, the ancestor of the Messiah. Now, we know Messiah in Matthew chapter 1, the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Dennis Prager, I'm sure, is familiar with that chapter because he's intelligent, he's academic, he's a scholar. But Jesus is not the Messiah, but in Dennis Prager's mind. But nonetheless, the Messiah will come through Perez. the Messiah thus stems from a strange and non-indigenous, indigenous line. He will be the descendant, the Messiah, of both a Canaanite woman, Tamar, and a Moabite woman, Ruth. And then we could go on with Salmon and a Canaanite woman, Rahab, two nations that were historic enemies of Israel. This is one of the moral lessons of the Torah, Prager writes. Moral values matter more than national identity. I mean, that's Prager, a Jew, summing up this chapter right here, that moral values, and the moral value of this chapter was take care of Tamar. Forget the sexual things. I mean, that Onar spilling his seed, that was a problem. But that still falls under that category of not taking care of Tamar. And so that sums up the whole right there. I mean, we talk about in our culture right now, we talk about immigration. We talk about different races. This is it right here. This is it. This is one of the moral lessons of the Torah. Moral values matter more than national identity. There are people that are what I'd consider non-Americans or American citizens that their morals and their values separate them from me. Yeah, but they're citizens of the same country. They're not of my culture. They're not of mine. But there's people that are outside of the country, maybe immigrants, including a couple of my daughter-in-laws, that have come from other countries, but their moral values match my moral values. And so what matters is not nationality, not even genetics. What matters is morality. And that Prager saying that's the lesson of this chapter and of the genealogy of the Messiah, which he's still waiting for, which we know as to be Jesus. So that's interesting. I think it's interesting. I'll pray, and you're free to go or ask questions, make corrections. Father, do thank you for the chance of looking at these things. We thank you for giving us these examples. We thank you for setting the standard for us. We ask that we would be concerned about others, that we would take care of those in need, that we would follow after you and do the things you've called us to. We do thank you for your word, and we do thank you for the Savior, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.